Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Words of war. At an event commemorating the end of World War II, Vladimir Putin paints Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine as a response to Western policies. Then, an uncertain future. A lawyer who argued a landmark abortion rights case before the U.S. Supreme Court weighs in on the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned. And rising hunger. The ordinary citizens of Afghanistan struggle to meet their basic needs as the Taliban further restricts the rights of women, drawing international condemnation.
With the international community putting sanctions on Afghanistan, the Taliban aren't suffering from this. It's the common Afghans.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Today, in Moscow and Kyiv, two countries at war fought over the meaning of what used to be a shared holiday, Victory Day, when Russia, Ukraine, and all the former Soviet states celebrate the defeat of Nazi Germany. But this year, the Kremlin compared Ukrainians to Nazis, and Ukrainians compared Russian actions to Nazi war crimes. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
They filled Moscow's streets by the tens of thousands, Russians remembering family killed during World War II, mobilized by a leader leveraging an 80-year-old victory to justify today's war. With pomp, circumstance, and a show of military might, Russian President Vladimir Putin likened the Red Army's fight against the Nazis to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
You are fighting for the motherland, for its future, so that no one forgets the lessons of World War II. So there is no place in the world for executioners, castigators, and Nazis.
Putin did not escalate the war or declare victory. Instead, he once again inflated Western pre-war support for Ukraine as his reason to invade.
We saw how the military infrastructure was being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work. There were regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries. The danger grew every day. Russia has preemptively repulsed an aggression. It was a forced, timely, and the only correct decision.
Ukraine's rebuttal uploaded online. On the street where Kyiv usually hosts an Independence Day parade, President Volodymyr Zelensky walked past barricades and compared an unnamed Putin to Hitler.
Someone is fighting for the Tsar, the Führer, and we are fighting for our freedom, so that the victory of our ancestors was not in vain. The one who is repeating the horrific crimes of Hitler's regime today, he is doomed, because he was cursed by millions of ancestors when he began to imitate their killer, and therefore he will lose everything. And very soon, there will be two victory days in Ukraine, and someone will not even have one left. We won then. We will win now, too.
The Soviet army turning the Nazi six-month assault into the most ghastly military disaster in German history.
Ukraine and Russia shared sacrifices in World War II. 20 million Soviets died, and across Ukraine, Nazis committed war crimes. But in Kharkiv's World War II memorial today, the only heartbeats allowed were recorded in the past and piped in by speaker. The memorial was closed by Kharkiv Mayor Ihor Terekhov, whose father was a Soviet soldier.
Ukraine was entirely occupied by Nazi Germany, and Ukraine was liberated with the help of our allies, the United States, Great Britain. The whole world liberated us from the Nazis and fascists. And today, history is repeating itself. The United States, Great Britain, they're all providing us with weapons.
Welcome, folks.
Today in the U.S., President Biden signed the Ukraine Democracy Defense Lend-Lease Act. It borrows the name of U.S. support to allies during World War II and makes it easier to arm Ukraine.
And, with Putin's war once more bringing wanton destruction into Europe and to reaffirm the enduring commitment to the future grounded in democracy, human rights, and peaceful resolution of disagreements, I'm now going to sign this bill.
But at a European meeting in France today, President Emmanuel Macron ended Ukraine's hope to join the European Union quickly and said Russia's priorities needed to be considered.
The terms of the discussion and negotiation will be established by Ukraine and Russia. It won't happen by ignoring or excluding one or the other.
Back in Ukraine, Russia continues to bombard and try to storm Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant, the city's last holdout. For 2 months, hundreds of civilians have been hiding underneath Azovstal with no light or fresh air and little food and water. In the last 10 days, the UN and ICRC have escorted three convoys of families out of Azovstal. UN resident humanitarian coordinator Osnat Lubrani traveled with those convoys to the Ukrainian-held town Zaporizhia, where we sat down today.
The people who you've evacuated with, what are the conditions they've faced?
People that have undergone trauma, living in conditions that's difficult to imagine, in a bunker. They haven't seen the sky, they had limited food, and incessant shelling all the time. So bringing them out, the process of moving them was also not easy. There is presently, by the entities that are in control of these areas, a requirement to go through a screening process. We were present with them throughout that process, which was very lengthy and intensive. And for people, particularly the ones from Azovstal who have just come in, putting pressure on people that already have gone through a difficult time and very scary, I think, for all of them. I think that's where our presence with those vulnerable people that had just come out of a difficult situation was very important. And it was, protection by presence, being there.
We're talking about screening by Russian forces. What are the Russians making the people who are leaving Mariupol go through in that screening process?
I think there are a lot of probing questions. It's very lengthy and very comprehensive and very intense.
Is it unfair?
It was putting people under duress, but there was no actual abuse or to the extent that that's why we were there. There was no...
To ensure there was no abuse.
Yes, exactly.
What are the conditions that the people who remain in Mariupol face?
Right now, Mariupol is very much destroyed in terms of access to food and basic services. These are literally not there. I'm hoping that we can also be there for the people that are living in a very, very dire conditions. There is Russian presence, but there is also the presence of other entities that are now sort of controlling people's daily lives. In this regard, I want to say that the UN does have a presence for many years in Donetsk and Luhansk. We have, on the basis of humanitarian principles, been able to engage with all of these entities on access, on bringing humanitarian aid. So I hope that those same, arrangements can be worked out.
It sounds like you're making a pitch to the pro-Russian separatists who you've been dealing with for many years in the self-declared independent republics in Donetsk and Luhansk, who are now in Mariupol. The pitch is that you can work with them inside Mariupol.
I think, yes, that's the pitch.
As part of the evacuation efforts, have families from Mariupol been separated?
People have ended up in different situations.
Air raid sirens in the distance. Sirens.
Yes, there have been instances of family separation. There were several instances where people were detained because they were either under investigation or were detained because they were considered involved as,
meaning former soldiers or former police.
Right? Yes, and that involved separation of those people from family members,
from
sometimes children. Yeah. Sometimes children and siblings. But in all those instances, we will be following up.
Osnat Lubrani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a note, our coverage of the war in Ukraine is supported in partnership with the Pulitzer Center. In the day's other news, more selling weighed down Wall Street amid worries about interest rates and China's economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 653 points, 2%, to close at 32,245. The Nasdaq fell 521 points, that's 4%. The S&P 500 sank 3% to its lowest close since March of last year. The son of one-time Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos scored a landslide victory today in the country's presidential election. Unofficial tallies showed Ferdinand Marcos Jr. winning a big majority of the votes cast. The current vice president, Lenny Robredo, lagged well behind. By evening, jubilant supporters had gathered outside Marcos' headquarters.
We are happy with the big lead because we have been hearing about issues like malfunctioning vote counting machines, system glitches, but it seems unity is in the lead, our unity, Marcos' intention of unifying the Filipinos. We're very happy.
The elder Marcos was ousted in 1986 in a popular revolt against martial law, corruption, and human rights abuses. He died in 1989. The Prime Minister of Sri Lanka resigned today after weeks of protests amid an economic crisis. Earlier, pro-government demonstrators broke through police lines in the capital and clashed with protesters. Authorities called out soldiers to quell the unrest. The death toll has reached 35 in Havana, Cuba, after Friday's explosion at a luxury hotel. Search crews continued working into the night and through today, clearing debris and looking for potential survivors. It is believed that a gas leak ignited the blast. In China, authorities in Shanghai intensified anti-COVID measures today, despite a drop in cases. The government barred more residents from going outside or ordering non-essential goods. It gave no explanation. And back in this country, the Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism for 2021 were awarded. The Washington Post won for its coverage of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The New York Times won for stories on traffic stop deaths, with many of the victims black, and for reporting on U.S. drone strikes in the Middle East. The Journalists of Ukraine received a special citation for their war coverage. And in the arts, Joshua Cohen's book, The Netanyahus, took the fiction prize, while playwright James Imes won the drama award for Fat Ham. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Biden administration pushes for more affordable internet access for low-income Americans. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter weigh the latest political news. Musician John Batiste talks about the next phase of his musical journey, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The leaked early draft of the Supreme Court's majority opinion overturning the federal right to an abortion has advocates on both sides of the issue primed for battle. John Yang begins tonight's coverage.
Judy, after the prospect of the court overturning Roe v. Wade led to a weekend protest outside the homes of some conservative justices, including Brett Kavanaugh, the White House today cautioned against threats, violence, or vandalism. The case currently before the court is the first major challenge to Roe since a 1992 case called Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey. And while the court upheld some restrictions on abortion in that case, it also reaffirmed a woman's right to choose to have an abortion before a fetus is viable and to do so without undue government interference. Catherine Colbert argued that case for Planned Parenthood. She's the co-author of the book Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. Catherine Colbert, thanks so much for joining us. First of all, I have to ask, what was your reaction to the draft opinion that was leaked last week?
Well, you know, I wasn't surprised. I've been saying for some time that this current court, an ultra-conservative court, was poised to overrule Roe. But I was surprised by its vehemence. I think the way that the decision was crafted not only showed the closeness of these particular justices to the anti-abortion movement. They used language from the anti-abortion movement. They used arguments put forward by those who oppose abortion. But more importantly, they opened the door to eradicating a whole host of rights that are based upon the 14th Amendment. And I was surprised by that. I thought it would be much narrower.
And in the opinion in the case you argued that you won, they spent a lot of time, the justices in that opinion spent a lot of time talking about precedent and the importance of precedent to the institution, institutional integrity of the court. In Alito's draft, he wrote that precedent is not an inexorable command and that it's at its weakest when we interpret the Constitution. Last week, Justice Thomas said that precedent was a mantra when we don't want to think. You just talked about what impact this might have on other cases and other rights. Talk about that a little bit, what this might bode for the future.
Well, I think the really critical part of the decision is the five justices of this court have said that they can overrule a long history of support for civil rights and civil liberties because they individually disagree with it. And that has never been the case. What has the doctrine of stare decisis says that when a law is made, it ought to be respected from generation to generation, and only in really specific circumstances, when the underlying law has changed, when the circumstances, the factual underpinnings of a case have changed, it ought to be upheld. And I think the hard part here is, let's think about this. We have had 5 decades of support for Roe versus Wade, and then entire generations of women in this country have relied upon this decision and frankly ordered their lives. Millions of women have obtained abortions as a result of Roe, and all of that is being rolled back because 5 individuals decided, in my view, willy-nilly to change the law. And I think that is a real hit on the institutional integrity of this court.
Justice Alito, I think, tried to address that when he wrote that that abortion is different from the other sort of liberty-based rights the court has found, like intimate sexual relations, contraception, and marriage. He said that abortion destroys a life, and therefore it's different. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, the rights guaranteed in Roe are what I think of as reciprocal. That is, the right to make a decision to have an abortion, but also to decide to carry a pregnancy to term. That is, to go both ways. It's protecting the decisional interests of a woman. And so that's no different, no matter if you're using contraception or you're deciding to be sexually active with a person of the same sex, or you decide to enjoy same-sex marriage or even interracial marriage. All of those rights are based on the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says that important decisions about all people's lives ought to be protected. They ought to belong to the individual and not to politicians.
The draft that was leaked is marked first draft. In your case, the case you won, which is referred to as Casey, we learned much later that there was a first draft that was quite different from where the court ended up. Tell us about that.
Yes, right after my oral argument, the court retired to their conference room. There was a vote of the justices, and 5 justices did vote to overrule Roe. At the time, Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote a draft opinion, and I know much narrower than Justice Alito's draft opinion, but Justice Kennedy, at the last minute, changed his vote, joined with Justice Souter and Justice O'Connor, and came up with the decision in Casey, which protected the right to choose abortion, gave states greater ability to restrict those rights, but ultimately meant that for the last 2 decades, we've had legal abortion in this country. The interesting part of that is that, everyone says, well, that could happen here. I don't think so. There's no Justice Kennedy on this current court. All of the members in the majority, the 5 justices who joined, the 4 justices who joined Samuel Alito, are are very, very conservative. They come from the anti-abortion movement. They were nominated on the promise of reversing Roe. And I just don't see any of these ideologically based justices changing their minds as Justice Kennedy did.
Do you think, I mean, this obviously was a first draft. I think it's 2 months old. It's hard to believe it's not already obsolete, that there are other more current drafts. There's a more current draft. Do you think any of the language is going to change? Any that you talked about, anything is going to change?
I think there may be some moderation in the language. But the reality is there are five very, very ultra-conservative justices who are intent on undermining the ability of women to be equal in this society, and they're making their views known.
Katherine Colbert, who argued for Planned Parenthood in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And on tomorrow's NewsHour, we will hear from a lead attorney opposed to abortion rights. It's been almost 9 months and a long winter since the Taliban took over Afghanistan. The economy is in freefall and people are suffering. The World Food Program estimates half of the country's population will be acutely food insecure this year. And nearly 9 million of those people could endure famine-like starvation. But even with this widespread suffering, the Taliban yesterday announced a new priority, ordering all women be completely covered head to toe when leaving their homes, requiring them again to don the burqa that was a telltale of their first rule. Special correspondent Jane Ferguson has this update on a nation in crisis.
The holy month of Ramadan is not only a sacred time for Muslims to fast from dawn till dusk, it's also a time for giving to the poor. April marked the first such holy month under the new Taliban government in Afghanistan. This year, the ranks of the poor included almost everyone, like Bibi Gul, a widow with 6 children to feed in Kabul.
I have a lot of hardships, like the rent, electricity bill, and medicine when the children get ill. Life is hard. I earn $1.50 a day, sometimes nothing. I go outside to find food and sell plastic bags. Sometimes I make money and sometimes nothing. The children need bread. I must find food for them.
As poverty has spiked and hunger set in following the collapse of the former government last August and the chaotic American withdrawal, Afghans who can help are organizing, pooling their money to keep fellow citizens alive as best they can.
It's not that Afghans have rolled over and accepted their fate.
Obaidullah Bahir was an academic researcher before the collapse. He believes local, smaller charities must step in as the international community falls short in its support.
There are kids in our hospitals who are wasting. Wasting is the extreme end of starvation where your body is eating itself up. I've helped such patients. I've seen such patients die, right? We already have statistics of thousands of babies in Afghanistan dying from starvation and malnutrition. And now with the changes, with the international community putting sanctions on Afghanistan, the Taliban aren't suffering from this. It's the common Afghans.
When the Taliban seized power last August, the U.S. immediately placed sanctions on their government, making it difficult to send money into the country. Some exceptions have been made for aid, but the freezing of billions of dollars of state assets in foreign banks has caused Afghans to lose access to their savings and contributed to the economic collapse of the country. As the Taliban have tightened their draconian rule, especially with regards to women's rights, the situation has worsened. Women are barely able to work. They're so heavily policed if they leave home. Running businesses and going out to sell their goods in markets is all but impossible now. Whatever struggling economy there is, they have been cut off from it. For Ramadan, the Taliban made a rare exception and permitted women to have their own market. Roya Hafizi founded the Women's Chamber of Commerce 5 years ago. She represents a whole generation of female small business owners now effectively shut in their homes most of the time.
We have witnessed a political revolution in our country where all the achievements, all the gains of the past 20 years now seem like a lie. They have vanished.
This is an extremely rare opportunity for these women to get out of the house, gather together, and sell their wares again. To outside observers, it seems like a publicity stunt by the Taliban. Now that Eid is over, the full rules are back in place. Rahila Askari has her own handcrafts business, but her future as she had once pictured it seems impossible now.
Going outside, having the work, having the job, and having even the basic right of education, it's difficult to us. And to go outside, we don't have this right. Without a mahram, like father, brother, son, without these people, without men, we are nothing. And it is a bad thing for women, for a human. Because when we say you have the right of human, it's not just for men. When I say I live in this situation, I just wanna cry.
Others are more defiant, like Aziza Zahra Naimi. She owns a honey-making business.
I can't tolerate this situation anymore. For a day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, or a month. How long will they silence us? But a point will come where we would say, even if you kill us, we can't tolerate this anymore. This system won't work with violence, darkness, and force. For how long? No one can hold a nation hostage.
The Taliban have their own crisis too, beyond economics, an identity one.
The Taliban now need to shift from being a jihadist insurgency to a ruling group. And that regime needs to do business with the outside world. So they're going to have to be pragmatic. And it's a difficult balancing act. For 20 years, you've built an organization that was designed to fight, and you motivated people to engage in suicide bombings. They don't turn into people who are government officials overnight.
Kamran Bukhari is an expert on Afghanistan and extremist groups with New Lines Institute and magazine.
They can't govern without compromising. And if they compromise, they cannot maintain ideological purity. When you can't maintain ideological purity, you're going to lose people to ISIS, which is a far more radical group. ISIS was watching this and saw it, had gamed this out.
ISIS in Afghanistan, known as ISIS Khorasan or ISIS-K, has been a bitter, rising rival of the Taliban for years. Last August, during the deadly American-led evacuation efforts from Kabul, it was an ISIS suicide bomber who blew himself up at the gates of Kabul airport, killing over 150 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members. As the Taliban struggle to govern, they are stuck between those inside their rank and file who don't think they are hardline enough and the new generation of Afghans and wider global diplomatic community pushing back against their repressive rule.
What we have left behind is a vibrant civil society that is used to a certain freedoms, where women are, shoulder to shoulder in society. There's no way the Taliban can cow those people down. So that's a challenge for the Taliban. So the Taliban are not designed to govern, and they're only designed to fight. And the ISIS is looking at this and saying, this is, the environment that we're looking for, the conditions that we want to exploit.
Civilians are suffering from that exploitation the most cruelly. Bombings by ISIS in Afghanistan have been increasing throughout Ramadan, some even targeting small boys in school. As Ramadan ends and Afghanistan approaches summer, bringing with it a potentially more complex and vicious fighting season, the violence is likely to increase. Afghanistan's people will struggle to feed themselves while sheltering from those fighting over the carcass of the last war. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson.
The so-called digital divide remains a major issue in America when it comes to providing high-speed internet, particularly in rural areas and low-income communities. Today, the Biden administration announced new commitments from 20 commercial internet providers to help close that gap by lowering the cost of high-speed internet for millions of Americans. Stephanie Tsai gets an assessment of these latest efforts.
Judy, White House officials say nearly 40% of U.S. households qualify for what's called the Affordable Connectivity Program. The agreement with providers such as Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and others offers eligible families high-speed internet at a cost of no more than $30 a month. Most eligible families will get subsidies to essentially eliminate those costs. The money comes from the infrastructure law. President Biden spoke today about why better service is essential.
High-speed internet is not a luxury any longer. It's a necessity. And that's why the bipartisan infrastructure law included $65 billion to make sure we expand access to broadband internet in every region of the country, urban, suburban, and rural. And if you qualify, you're going to get a $30 credit per month toward your internet bill, which most folks will mean they get on for nothing. Look, zero.
Joining me now is Nicole Turner-Lee. She's the director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. Nicole, thank you so much for your time. So previous administrations have tried to deal with this issue of affordability. $60 to $70 a month is a burden for a lot of households to get high-speed internet. How big of a deal is it that the Biden administration has gotten these subsidies done, and how big of a shift is it from previous policy?
Well, Stephanie, thanks for having me. Listen, this is a big deal, and I'm going to tell you why it's a big deal for several reasons. First and foremost, it's a public-private sector partnership, and one we haven't seen in a while when it comes to providing internet access to low-income families or other vulnerable populations, including those on tribal lands. It's also a big deal because what we have found out in this pandemic is that families struggle. I mean, when you think about the fact that 34% of low-income adults struggle to keep their internet on at a time when they were working and learning, we needed something like this. And I think this is a great way for us to bring more people into the digital economy.
So 11.5 million households have already signed up for this subsidy. What are the barriers to getting more people signed up? And does the administration have a plan for getting the word out that you think will work?
Yeah, you know, the administration has thought long and hard about this, right? Along with the companies that are major companies, Comcast, Verizon, Spectrum, and a host of others, as you mentioned. They thought about how to raise awareness, and that's going to be a big deal. How do you get people to really come to either the store of these companies, or the administration has put together a website, getinternet.gov, for folks to get access. I know in certain states and cities, they're going to do text message campaigns. The key thing for people to know is, if you are receiving certain government assistance, you can actually get access to this program. And so we're going to need an all hands on deck strategy, I think, to get more people with awareness that they can actually receive this $30 subsidy.
As you said, Nicole, this was a private-public partnership. The nation's biggest service providers agreed to offer these lower cost, supposedly high quality internet plans. By the way, that's 100 megabits per second. That's what qualifies as high speed. But some underserved areas, Nicole, still lack access to broadband infrastructure. Those companies have been accused by some activists of furthering that digital divide by not providing adequate internet to poor neighborhoods. Is that true, or is this a government policy problem?
You know, I like the way that you actually bring this up. I mean, look, even in the excitement, we have to keep questioning what other challenges do we have. We know right now, Stephanie, we do not have universal broadband. So there will be a proportion of people who will not get access simply because there are no facilities or they just don't have a choice of the providers that are participating in the program. So I think we have to keep remembering in tandem with this is the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And in tandem with that is the fact that we are going to deploy more broadband assets across the U.S. And we're going to find ways to actually do digital literacy training. I think if we look at this in and of itself, it is a huge accomplishment. I've been doing this for a really long time. So thank you, President Biden and Vice President Harris. But I do think we have to have these with simultaneous programs if it's going to be fully effective.
As you mentioned, the pandemic really highlighted some of the social inequities brought up by broadband access. In fact, nearly half of Americans who don't have at-home internet are in Black and Hispanic households. I wonder if you talk about that a little bit. What do we know about how economic, educational, and health outcomes are impacted by this lack of broadband access in those households?
You know, I love that you asked that question, because we have to think of it also that when we're talking about closing the digital divide, we're not just talking about bits and bytes, you know, tablets or laptops and service. We're talking about changing the trajectory of inequality. And I think what we have to understand that the digital divide is more than just the technology itself. It's about a pathway to some of the economic opportunities that are available. When 50 million school-age kids were actually sent home and 15 to 16 million of them did not have broadband access to learn, that was a problem. And unfortunately, it did disproportionately affect Black and Brown and Native students who really needed access to learn. And I'm not just talking at K through 12, I'm talking about college students as well, who left their campuses and went homes where there were internet deserts. So I think, Stephanie, to your point, I think as we look at this entire trajectory, we have to keep reminding ourselves that this is about closing the inequality gap. And when we close that gap in this digital economy, I think we'll be better off in the long run.
Nicole Turner-Lee with the Brookings Institute. And thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Last week's report that the Supreme Court plans to overturn Roe v. Wade put one of the country's most divisive political issues back on center stage. Abortion is suddenly again a dominant issue in Congress, in state houses, and on the campaign trail. Joining me to assess the political fallout of this and more are Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Hello to both of you. Welcome to the NewsHour, Politics Monday. And as you just heard, there's a lot to talk about. Let's, for that bombshell leak is still having repercussions. Tam, we are seeing fallout. Let's talk about the states first. You're seeing movement in some of the states like Louisiana. They've been moving toward more restrictions. We're seeing that. We're also seeing some states that want to preserve abortion rights moving to codify it. What does it add up to?
Well, and what you had just today is Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer saying that that they can't wait for Congress to do something, and they can't wait for Congress to do something because Congress is not going to do something. There are a number of states where there are ballot measures being circulated for constitutional amendments. Some of those would expand abortion access or put in the Constitution that it is a right to have reproductive rights. Others would restrict abortion access. And what you are going to see if this draft opinion becomes official is what you saw in the past, which is a real patchwork where some states will become havens for people seeking reproductive services, and other states will become no-go zones for abortion.
And Amy, it does get more complicated in states with divided government. There's some real battles that are going to play.
Well, that's why Governor Whitmer in Michigan said, look, I'm not going to get anything done with the legislature. It's a Republican legislature. So she and the state attorney general are suing the state, arguing that within the Constitution, there's a right to privacy. I think we're going to see that in other states where you have Democratic governor, Republican legislators. But what we're also seeing is attorneys general saying, well, in many states that do have these so-called trigger laws that go back to the previous law before Roe versus Wade that outlawed abortion, we're not going to enforce it. And I think that's going to be another battleground. It's not just attorneys general, but maybe even prosecutors in counties or areas, maybe if you're in a red state, a blue area that says we're not going to prosecute, or in a blue area, you might have a very committed person who's a county commissioner or a county prosecutor that decides they're going to try to do something more. So this battle, it's not just between the states, it's likely to be within the states as well.
So a patchwork across the country. And meantime, here in Washington, Tam, at the federal level, you are seeing those who support abortion rights moving the House and the Senate, where they face a really tough set of rules.
Certainly, there's this thing, we've talked about it before.
Yes.
There's a filibuster.
I was going to let you say the word first.
and it's insurmountable in the Senate right now for Democrats. They simply don't have the votes. It's not even clear that they all completely agree on the path forward. And And yet they are going to try to take a vote. They are going to bring this up. Leader Schumer is going to bring it up because they have to show that they're trying. They have to show that they are doing something, even though the results are unlikely to satisfy just about anyone. And the challenge that a lot of Democrats face in this midterm year is that there's a lot of frustration among base voters that there are a lot of things that that Democrats haven't accomplished. And Democrats keep saying, well, just elect Democrats and then we can preserve this or we can do this. And there are great limits to that, and there's frustration among voters.
And meantime, Amy, we've seen, I think what some people didn't expect was the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, in an interview over the weekend, and I'm just going to quote, he says, if this leaked opinion became the final opinion, legislative bodies, not only at the state level, but at the federal level, certainly could legislate in that area, suggesting, it sounds like, that he's thinking about a federal rule against abortion rights.
And this goes to Tam's point, which is Democrats can make the argument, well, maybe we can't go on the offense, but at least we can be there on defense.
Right.
The reason to keep Democrats in office is to ensure that Republicans don't get 60 votes, that they're never going to be able to reach a point where they can push through more restrictive federal laws.
Tam, this was not what people expected.
Yeah, well, in some ways, this is surprising because he's giving a really great talking point to Democrats who are headed into a challenging year. He's giving them something to talk about. But and what's fascinating about it is that McConnell is very restrained. They spent all of last week saying, we're not going to talk about this. We're only going to talk about the leak. And so it is remarkable to then see them go in this direction.
Interesting. All right. So meanwhile, we're all talking about what voters are going to be voting on when the midterms happen later this year. But Amy, right now we are hearing from the White House that tomorrow President Biden is going to roll out a new message, a new argument for why his approach to the economy is better than the other guys. And he's going to talk about, not going to use the word Trump, apparently, but speak as we've ultra MAGA Republicans. What does this gain them, do you think?
Yeah, they need to make this election, Democrats do, not a referendum on the current economy or opinions about this current president, but they would like to make it a choice. Do you want to elect Republican fill-in-the-blank candidate who supports, as Mitch McConnell noted, a federal ban? Do you support Republicans like fill-in-the-blank who did not support the January 6th investigation? So keeping the focus on the more extreme or the places where Republicans are really uncomfortable and off of the places that Republicans would like to talk much more about, which, of course, is the economy, inflation.
So trying to draw a sharper contrast.
Yeah.
Is that what this is all about?
Well, and the whole ultra MAGA idea also is targeted directly at independent voters. So Democrats think all Republicans are bad, but independent voters don't think all Republicans are bad. And this is a way for the president, who has had this sort of bipartisan image that he has fostered and that he believes in, it allows him to say, look, not all Republicans are bad. It's just the ultra MAGA Republicans that are the problem. The other thing, as Amy says, they are trying to draw this contrast because they don't want to simply talk about the economy and sort of cede the economy to Republicans who generally in polls over time, the public has generally felt that Republicans are better on the economy. They want to be able to say the president, Democrats are better on the economy because of this.
I was just going to say, and Amy, when you see something like this, you know the White House has spent some time researching it.
Yeah.
They've
yeah.
been looking at
That's
what
right.
arguments might play well,
right.
shall we say.
Yeah, and to say, look, you may not like the direction that we're going in at this moment in time, but let me tell you the good things that we've done. That's what you'll hear from Democrats. And as one Democratic strategist said to me, you know, things may not be going that great right now, but these Republicans are extreme. It's even more dangerous to put them in office than to keep us here. That is, again, any party that is in charge of all three branches, that is a very common message that they make when things aren't going well for them. But voters are much more attuned to paying attention to what is scary for them right now than what could potentially be scary for them in the future. What Democrats are hoping is voters remember what it was like on January 6th. This wasn't just hypothetical.
And this abortion ruling,
that's right,
which is coming in the weeks ahead,
is real. It's
they
not
believe
hypothetical.
Will help them make that. Make right. that argument.
But this is also a clear indication that they know that the economy is going to be a very big deal, that inflation will be a big deal, and they need a message on that, too.
Yeah.
Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both. Politics Monday.
You're welcome. Welcome.
Thank you. Call him a man of many sounds. 35-year-old John Batiste received the most nominations of any artist at the recent Grammys, 11 in all, in a wide variety of categories. And he came away with the most wins, 5, including the biggest, Album of the Year, for his recording titled We Are. Jeffrey Brown spoke to Batiste recently about what led to that success and a new venture premiering soon, for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
John Batiste is a musician who loves tradition and also loves busting traditional categories.
Categories, for one, are very limiting and really put people in these silos that limit collaboration. It limits artists who are really irrepressible. When I move my body just like this, I don't
know why, but I feel like irrepressible is the word for Batiste. By watching the music video Freedom, shot in his native New Orleans, without a smile or getting up to dance around the room, he had the audience at the Grammys on its feet just ahead of taking home the biggest award of the night, Album of the Year.
John Batiste,
becoming the first Black artist in 14 years to win.
To have reached that moment, it felt almost like we got through the Matrix.
Yeah. But in your own way.
Yes, by being authentic, by being true to the art and focusing on the craft and making decisions that were truly authentic to everyone who was involved in this album.
Batiste comes from a musical New Orleans family and is steeped in the great jazz traditions of his city. He also studied and played Bach and other classical music as a child, and has undergraduate and master's degrees from the prestigious Juilliard Conservatory.
Give it up for John Batiste.
Since 2015, he's reached national audiences nightly as band leader on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, with his group Stay Human. A consummate, confident, and thrilling performer now, he says it wasn't always that way.
I think about my early experiences, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years old, first on stage, and I was very shy. I didn't really have the performer's gene when I first started out. You know,
it's
that's
hard
something
to imagine sitting here now.
I mean, the years of developing the craft of a performer, just like the same as developing the craft on my instrument.
Right.
You know, you really sit and you watch tapes, watch YouTube, watch all kinds of stuff of the past, of people who are around today. And then you go out and you put yourself in a position to execute on all these things that you've learned. And over time, you figure out your voice.
As notable as the number of Grammy nominations and wins was the range of categories, including jazz, R&B, American roots music for his single, Cry, the soundtrack for the film, Soul. The goal, he says,
to expand the perception of what is popular, what is in the popular space, to expand the art, to expand the perception of a Black artist, to expand the perception of someone who exists and has all of these influences and is not categorizable. And the goal at the end of the day is to add value to people's lives by the creations.
That also means taking music into the streets. He's known for his impromptu love riots, joyous marches through everyday life. He joined the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests after the killing of George Floyd.
We are the chosen ones.
And celebrated that movement with his song, We Are. He calls what he does social music.
This idea of what music was before it was just entertainment or a commodity, you know, this music that comes from rituals and spiritual practice and all these different ways of having music as a part of community.
You connect to that?
I connect to that deeply. For whatever reason, I just am drawn to that kind of expression of music and try to recreate that feeling and that intention.
I'm curious because we're coming from a news program, right?
Yes.
Every night, we're reporting on divisions in America. I listened to your wonderful song, We Are.
Yes.
A lot of people don't see much we in America today.
In schools, hospitals, community centers across the country, there's a lot of we. What you all do is a great service because people need the news. They need to know what's happening. But I also feel that in this global understanding of our world and in this age of media, we've lost touch with the community and we've lost touch with our localized thinking, our understanding of each other from a human to human perspective. And what I see is there's a lot of good that goes unnoticed and there's a lot that can be more. So it's both. There can be a lot more good.
Has your own sense of what you can do to foster community changed?
Oh, I'm just getting started.
Some of his new direction was on display at a recent rehearsal for American Symphony, a large-scale work he composed for an upcoming Carnegie Hall premiere. Bringing together different kinds of musicians and traditions, Batiste sees this as an ode to democracy itself. But even as he reaches new heights professionally, Batiste recently revealed personal struggles. His wife, author Suleika Jouad, is battling cancer for a second time. Batiste has said he learned of the Grammy nominations even as she was receiving chemotherapy for leukemia.
You know, I've always thought about the highs in life as opportunity to take stock in all the blessings you have. And I've thought of the challenges in life as an opportunity to really reflect on and be grateful for what's most important. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. And to have highs and lows all at once is actually an incredible source of lending perspective. Every time it feels new whenever you face a challenge or whenever you have success. And I think that it's important to have those thoughts as anchors. In this world with
a lot of problems. A deep commitment to his art and the life around him, serious in approach, and did I mention, irrepressible as a performer. Even at an interview, Batiste couldn't resist sitting down at the piano and inviting his interviewer to join in. Next up for John Batiste, he'll make his acting debut in a musical film version of The Color Purple, and plenty more music, on stage, on nightly TV, in the streets, everywhere.
Thank you, that's great.
You killed that. It's great, it's fire.
You killed that.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in New York.
How about that? Jeffrey Brown and John Batiste hit the keys. And on the NewsHour online, we take a look at how poor dental care for incarcerated people can impact them long after they leave prison. That's at pbs.org/NewsHour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.